Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 14, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about Ilya Soman's newest book, Eminent Domain, A Comparative Perspective. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Richard A. Epstein, Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law, and author Professor Ilya Soman, Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. I will turn it over to Professor Soman to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor Soman. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you also to Richard Epstein for agreeing to comment on the presentation in the book. He's certainly the world's leading taking scholar, and it's an honor to have him with us. Way back in 1795, Supreme Court Justice William Patterson wrote that eminent domain is a despotic power that exists in every country. But until the book that I co-edited, Eminent Domain, A Comparative Perspective, we've never really had a systematic effort to look at how eminent domain is used and abused in a large number of countries around the world. And that's what my co-editors and I have tried to do in this book. The other editors are Ho Jun Lee and Il Jung Kim, both leading Korean law and economic scholars. And there are contributions by scholars from a number of other countries, each looking at the eminent domain systems in their respective societies. So I'm going to start briefly by talking about the origins of the book. Then I'll give an overview of what the book covers and why it matters. And then in the latter part of the presentation, I'll talk about some interesting common patterns that I think we have discovered that recur in the use of eminent domain in many otherwise very different countries, and also some possible reforms that should be considered to deal with some of the very serious problems and abuses that we see both in the U.S. and also in countries around the world. I've been writing about eminent domain now for over 15 years, and when I started, I was looking at it pretty much entirely in an American context, and specifically, I was looking at the question of public use, which at that time was largely neglected by scholars. The Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that the government can only condemn private property and take it if it's for a public use, but the Supreme Court had long said, well, public use is almost anything that the government says that it is. So I started working on that and criticizing the doctrine in that area. And then a couple years later, the Kelo case happened in 2005, where the Supreme Court ruled that if you take private property from one private owner and give it to another for purposes of so-called economic development, that counts as a public use, and indeed almost any potential public benefit does. There was a huge outcry against this almost across the political spectrum in the U.S., and that focused a lot of attention on my work and that of other scholars in this area. But I still felt that it was very unlikely that anybody would be interested in my work if they were outside the United States. Yet over time, I started getting calls from people in Taiwan, in France, and in China when I wrote my book, The Grasping Hand, which is about the Kelo case and the issues it raises. A number of scholars and others from these other countries contacted me, and I was even invited to teach a course for a summer at a university in China about these issues. The reason for their interest is that, in fact, the same kind of problems with eminent domain that we have in the U.S. exist in many of these other countries, in some cases on a much larger scale. For instance, in China, many millions of people have been forcibly displaced by takings for various kinds of development projects. In 2015, some 2 years ago now, I was invited to give a talk about eminent domain in the United States at a conference organized by the Korea Development Institute, probably South Korea's leading public policy think tank. And there were also scholars there from other countries presenting about eminent domain there. And after the conference, I told the organizer, you know, we should take the proceedings of this conference and put it into a book. And they said, okay, that's fine. We can do that, but you have to co-edit the book. So I said, okay, fine, I'll do it. And eventually we got Cambridge University Press to publish the book, and here we are with the book having just come out a few weeks ago. So in the book, there are chapters on eminent domain systems in a number of different countries and parts of the world. I have a chapter on the United States. There's an excellent chapter on Germany by Hans Bernd Schaefer, one of Europe's leading law and economics scholars. There's a chapter on Taiwan. There's a chapter that looks at the developing world and issues with eminent domain there. There's also a chapter that looks more broadly at Europe. And there's a number of chapters that look at the development of eminent domain in South Korea, which was a major part of the original focus of the conference. And in each chapter, we look at six important aspects of the eminent domain system in the country in question. One is the public interest or public use criteria, which restrict takings, the purposes for which the government is allowed to condemn property. Another is what entities are empowered to condemn. In some countries, including in many states in the U.S., private organizations sometimes are allowed to condemn property as well as public ones. The third topic is compensation. How much compensation do people get if their property is condemned? We also look at procedural restrictions on takings. What sorts of procedures does the government have to follow before they can take your land from you? In some cases, when takings work out well, which frankly they don't always do, there is a surplus that's created. There's additional wealth that's created by the project that replaces the previous use of the land. So we look at how that surplus is divided. For example, does the owner of the condemned property get any of it? And finally, we look at the dispute resolution system. How are disputes resolved if there's a disagreement about the legality of some aspect of the taking? And in looking at these different countries, obviously there's a lot of diversity between these societies, and certainly not all the authors in the book necessarily agree with each other. Nonetheless, we found a surprising number of common patterns that recur in many different societies, despite the fact that in other respects, there's a lot of divergence between these countries. One is, it is very common for these sorts of takings, for the use of eminent domain, to victimize the poor and the politically weak for the benefit of powerful interest groups. This is especially common in developing countries, which are relatively poor, where you have a sort of political and economic elite, which can use eminent domain to exploit the rest of the population. What is going on in China is the largest scale example of this, where you literally have many millions of people forcibly displaced, often for the benefit of influential developers or for the benefit of influential people in government and the like. But this also happens in many other developing countries, including in Korea during the time that it was developing, in many parts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and so on. But importantly, this problem happens not just in third world countries or developing nations. It also occurs in mature liberal democracies, including our own. Between World War II and the 1970s, the U.S. forcibly displaced several million people through economic development and white condemnations. Most of them were poor minorities, often through urban renewal programs, which critics dubbed Negro removal because they often tended to remove poor African Americans. These sorts of problems continue to this day in the U.S., albeit on a lesser scale. The Kelo case is somewhat of an example of this, where you had people with relatively low political influence lose their home for the benefit of, among others, Pfizer Inc., a very powerful corporation. One reason why this occurs in many countries is that although most countries have some kind of public use or public interest constraints on takings, often those constraints have been watered down, as they were in the U.S. The Supreme Court in Kelo and previous cases like Berman versus Parker said that a public use is virtually anything that might create some conceivable public benefit. So pretty much any taking for the benefit of some sort of private interest or public one could qualify. Another common pattern is undercompensation of people who lose their property to takings. And this occurs in the U.S., in Korea, in many developing nations, in Taiwan and elsewhere. That in the U.S., for example, the Supreme Court says that there must be fair market value compensation. So if your land is condemned, you're supposed to at least get what the market price of the land would be if it's sold on the market. A lot of research suggests that in reality, regardless of what the Supreme Court says, often people don't even get that fair market value. And even when they do get it, it doesn't fully account for their true losses. It doesn't account for the so-called subjective value that many people invest in their property. Many people value it above the market price for a number of reasons. It also doesn't account for the goodwill that businesses lose and so on. Sadly, it's also common for these sorts of takings in many societies to destroy more economic value than they create. That has certainly happened with urban renewal and blight and economic development condemnations in the U.S. The Kiwo case is a particularly extreme example where, to this day, nothing has actually been built on the condemnation site except for some makeshift shelters for feral cats. So the feral cats benefited, but overall there was an economic loss to the community. And finally, an interesting pattern is that I think this is the reason for the interest in this issue in many countries. It's interesting that both in the U.S. and in many other societies that we've looked at, a severe political conflict has emerged over these kind of takings. Cases like Kiwo occur, which captured a public imagination and focus attention on these abuses. There have been similar situations in Korea and China and elsewhere. For instance, in Korea, there was a notorious case of a taking, I believe, for a private golf course, benefiting some wealthy and influential people, and that attracted public ire. Also, as societies become more developed and as there's in some ways more political openness, people's consciousness does increase and protests occur. This has even occurred in an authoritarian society like China, where there have been some large-scale public protests protesting these sorts of land seizures. Often the protests are not strong enough to put an end to these kinds of abuses, but they do focus public attention on them, and they do create controversy. So what can be done about these problems? I don't think there's any one solution that will work in every society. And I also obviously have to recognize that there's disagreement between different authors, even in our own volume. Some advocate one set of solutions, some advocate others. But let me just briefly mention several possible approaches. One is to tighten up public use or public interest constraints on takings so that the government can't take property for so broad a range of purposes. I certainly advocate this, and so do some of the other authors in the book, including the author of the Korea chapter on this, Ho Jin Lee. Another approach is to increase compensation for takings. If we're going to have condemnation on this scale, we should at least more fully compensate the victims of it. And certainly I support that as well, at least to an extent. Some scholars argue that instead of trying to impose substantive constraints on takings, we should have instead more procedural constraints. Perhaps there should be more hearings and more public debate before these takings are done, more opportunity for people to express their concerns and opposition and the like. In developing countries, there is often a need for stronger judicial institutions. Often the courts are ineffective or corrupt or both, and that's a very serious problem which goes beyond this issue, obviously, and affects other questions. But I would also emphasize that merely having a strong system of judicial review with well-qualified judges is not necessarily enough. We have that in the U.S., but despite that, we have very serious eminent domain abuse. So I think the bottom line is that there's a variety of possible options, and there's a lot to be learned from looking at the way these issues have developed in countries around the world. For the listeners who I assume are mostly, if not exclusively, Americans, I think it's also worth recognizing that our debates over eminent domain and related issues have an effect and a resonance not just in this country, but around the world. The Kelo case and its aftermath have been cited and often mentioned by both sides in the debate over takings in China and in Taiwan and in Korea and Israel and many other places around the world. So this is one of those areas where the eyes of the world are upon us, and that's yet another reason why we should strive to get these issues right if we can. Thank you very much.
Ilya is a man of remarkable prudence. He has said he was going to talk for about 15 minutes, and he talked for about 15 minutes. I'll probably talk a little bit less than him, and there's a little bit of Coles to Newcastle's, because I think with respect to the diagnosis of the problem and the possible solution, the two of us would certainly be regarded as much closer as allies rather than as opponents with deep philosophical differences. So let me then just make a couple of points which I think are adjacent to his, rather than to repeat my approval of what he has said. I mean, the first question that one has to ask is, why is it in this area, like in virtually every other area that you look at, the secret for understanding comparative law is to recognize that the differences are far less important than the similarities, given the nature of the underlying problems that take place. There's often a tendency in dealing with these kinds of issues to note that there's some distinctive procedure in this, that, or the other country which is not replicated in some other case, or that there's some very difficult case that comes out one way in one country and may come out in another. But the underlying problems that all societies face in order to keep themselves coherent are pretty much the same. And in order to deal with that, the simplest maxim one has to realize is that in dealing with ordering of human affairs, there are only two ways that you can do it with variations. One of them is through coercion, and the other is through consent. And by and large, consent tends to be the preferred method, because if you use consent as between two individuals, then in effect the transaction will not take place unless both sides turn out to be the gainer. And whereas if you allow coercion to be unilaterally imposed by one side, there's always the danger that you're going to come up with something that looks all too much like theft, in this case legalized theft through the government. And so what happens is you then have to try to identify those kinds of situations for which you think that the coercive power of the state is going to be justified. And it turns out that you can do that, and that's the essence of the public use question, but what's the appropriate situation? And I think the answer in terms of the classical theory is that the government should be allowed to use coercion with compensation under those circumstances where the individual on the other end of the transaction has a huge amount of holdout power and threatens to capture the surplus, the entire surplus, or a very large fraction of it, from those people who have put it together. And the classic illustration of this is with long and skinny property. You want to build a railroad across the country, and Farmer Jones is sitting there right in the middle, and he says, I'll let you have my plot of land, just give me half of the potential gain from the railroad, remembering that if I don't give you this particular plot of land, all the cars that are huddled on the east side of the divide won't get to the west side of the divide, and so forth, and the opposite. And if one guy can do this, then 10 guys can do it, so by the time you're done, you would have a series of holdout problems, and you could be pretty confident that nothing ever will happen, because the divided constituencies will demand in sum a total equal to or greater than the total surplus that the government project was going to put into place, so the whole thing would start to die. And what the eminent domain power is designed to do in those cases is to say, look, we want to make sure that this project makes sense, and if we give you the best value that you have to your particular property outside of the government taking, then in effect you're going to be indifferent to whether the property is taken or not. And if we can meet that requirement, we could then appropriate the rest of the project's benefits to the public at large, in which you, old individual property owner, will in fact participate in along with everybody else. And if you take that particular model with the holdout situation, the just compensation, the narrow compensation for uses, it turns out that the classic formula found in the United States Constitution and imitated in one form or another by just about everybody else starts to make perfectly good sense. What happens is the government coerced the taking of the property in question. It has to be for a public use, and there has to be just compensation. And all three of those elements turn out to be in the particular case that we have. Now, why is it that this system has broken down as badly as it has done? And I think that the explanation for this, at least in the case of outright takings, comes in the attitude that one brings towards government. If you go back to the early constitutions in the United States and sort of the regnant political theory that took place before the rise of the modern social welfare state, you might want to summarize what's going on in a single sentence, which says that all government action is taken under a presumption of error. That is, we understand that the coercive powers are really very, very dangerous. We know that we have to have them, but what we do is we keep them under a tight leash, either through some kind of powerful political tradition on the one hand, or through a series of constitutional or customary constraints. The latter, by the way, were never to be underestimated. If you look at a place, for example, like Great Britain, it turns out they don't have a written constitution, but they certainly have something very equivalent to the rules that are in place everywhere else, namely that the government cannot seize property for a public use unless it pays just compensation, so that the cultural situation leads to the same kinds of results. Now, if in fact you really believe in the presumption of error, what happens is all the vices that Ilya points out will tend to fade away. You think that there's a real danger of government abuse? You really are going to look to see that there's some kind of a problem that justifies the government taking. It may be that you have to build an essential facility at a given location, or it may well be that there's a holdout problem. One of the real issues in the United States 100 years ago was whether or not you could take property and give it to a private party to build a mill and so forth, and it turned out that the answer was yes, you could do it under those circumstances if it turns out that the people who were flooded would have a huge holdout problem and therefore could prevent the proposition from taking place. So that public use in the American law developed into two halves. One half was, yes, it was going to be built for a hospital or school or something of that sort, and the other half was that it would be for a facility which, unless you had government coercion, could never assemble the useful parcels needed to bring it into place. And that was pretty much accepted long before the 2005 Kelo case to which Ilya referred. And, of course, what was so apparent about the Kelo situation is the government had not the slightest idea of what it was going to do with her particular property. She was holding out not for more money. She just wanted to stay there. So they didn't have a purpose, and she wasn't trying to extract. And nonetheless, they forced this deal on her with the catastrophic consequences that Ilya had mentioned. So the first point is you now will define public use relatively narrow because you're suspicious of the government. And then the second question is going to be, well, how much do you have to pay? And if you really think that these government guys are dangerous and you want to make sure that the property is going to be worth more in public hands than in private hands, you're going to keep that compensation figure up fairly high. And it's going to include not only market value, but you try to do something about subjective value, because after all, these properties don't have for sale signs on them. So we know that the owner values them more than the market, so even just compensation is undercompensation. In addition, movement, when it's involuntary, has all sorts of complications, and so you have to worry about the loss of goodwill, which under American law has not compensated a mistake. You have to worry about consequential damages, taking all your stuff up and moving it somewhere else, finding other locations, doing an assessment and all of that. And it turns out under the American system, the reason why a just compensation system is a catastrophe is all the collateral costs are thought to be private, not to be borne by the government. So even if you get full compensation for the property, the other expenses, which are uncompensated, mean that you're left far worse off under this system than you would have been if the property had never been taken. And then, as Ilya mentions, oftentimes the government lowballs the kind of compensation that it gives because it knows perfectly well that individuals on the other side may not have the resources to contest this fully. And so what you do is you get these sort of real disparities. Some people come out with top dollar in these compensation cases. Other people come out with very little indeed. And so you've got the second problem, and if you're suspicious, you do it. The third problem, of course, is what he says, is what do you do about the question of procedures? And here, of course, it's very much a mixed blessing, because what sometimes in these happens is the government will give you so many procedures, and they're so costly that by the time you go through them all, you're exhausted, so you tend to take an offer rather than to have to sit there and to fight this thing through several levels of appeal on and on. Now, what led to the change from the sensible system of trying to get this done at a right price for limited purposes was, I think, the change that we have developed in the conception of what it is that governments are supposed to do. And under the older regime, they had limited functions, and the presumption was against their use. If you're a good progressive liberal, you believe in a combination of expertise in the administrative state, implementing democratic values about redevelopment and so forth. And so all of a sudden, you see all of this stuff about compensation, all of this stuff about limited purposes. It's just a nettlesome interference with the way in which people start to operate. And so what you do is you chip away at all these situations. And it's no mistake that if you start to look at the way in which the eminent domain law erodes in the United States, and I dare say elsewhere, is it starts at the time of the rise of the New Deal, where planning all of a sudden became this sort of magic bullet which would solve all of our social problems. And if you know that you're right, well, why do you want to have to make people pay to do the right thing? And there is a kind of a nice theorem about the eminent domain law, which is if you had perfect information and perfect governments, they would only do the right thing, and why would you want to incur the cost of compensation when everybody would be better off in the ex-ante perspective if nobody got a dime? Unfortunately, it's exactly what Ilya said. It's the imperfections that drive the particular system and have led to this state. So I think, in effect, you have to sort of push back on all the margins in order to take it. And then the question is, will you have solved the eminent domain problem? And I just want to mention one thing before we turn it back to Ilya for comment, which is his book, like many books, talks about only one half of the eminent domain problem. He's talking about cases where the government essentially takes occupation of the property so that the public use and the just compensation requirements are always going to be triggered. And you're going to have these huge valuation problems of one sort or another. And it's a huge part of the practice of law, particularly since sometimes the condemnation isn't of small plots of land, but it's utility easements and highway easements and all the other stuff, which are really very difficult to price, taking into account collateral losses and collateral gains. But in addition to that, the takings law has a second part, which is the imposition of regulations on land use or similar activities in other segments under the so-called Penn Central test, where this huge degree of government deference as to what you can do so long as you don't make a physical taking. And this test, essentially, I think in many ways is even more costly for the economy at large than is the problem that you have with Kelo. And let me just mention what it is. In the land use case after Kelo, there is no question that things have actually tightened up in the United States. People were so resentful of what went on that the level of abuse in this particular fashion started to go down, and people in local communities have some clout against their local governments and a lot of friends. But when you put land use restrictions on that prevent future development, the locals are often in favor of the restrictions because they will victimize the outsiders rather than themselves. And so these things start to take place, and you get zoning codes of great scope and situations which could reduce huge amounts of value for very little offsetting benefits. And also the takings issue, although it's not in Ilya's book, but one must remember this, it's not just confined to real estate. Patents, financial institutions have raised huge cases of this stuff, all of which are decided under this nefarious Penn Central case, so that the takings issue, if you want to understand it in its full scope, has its origins in the abuses in cases like Kelo and similar situations, but actually extends much further out to the entire scope of the regulatory state. And also, again, given the progressive benevolence that we have and our faith in large government, there's a very low standard of review on these particular cases because we're pretty convinced that our public agents are doing the right thing. The only problem with that particular assumption is that it's wrong. So anyhow, Ilya, do you have any comments back to me before we open it up?
Just very briefly, I agree with the vast bulk of what Richard has said, particularly the way he put this all into a broader perspective. I also agree that the broader takings puzzle includes not just eminent domain, but also regulatory takings. In fact, the other editors and I do have tentative plans to do a similar international comparative volume on regulatory takings, because that hasn't even really been done either, that there isn't a previous volume which tries to look at the way these are handled in countries around the world. But obviously, that idea is very much in its early stages, but I believe it's worth doing for precisely the reasons that Richard mentioned. I also, in principle, agree that ideally, you would want to have an eminent domain system where eminent domain can be used to overcome holdout problems where they exist but should be blocked elsewhere. But here I have a little bit of a disagreement with Richard on two fronts, one which may not be much of a disagreement, one which is perhaps a little bit bigger. The one which is may not actually be much of a disagreement is that I think it's too quick to assume that just because there is a holdout problem that we need to use eminent domain to overcome it. In many cases, private developers, when they're doing a private project, have other tools for dealing with it. For example, secret assembly. You can't be a strategic holdout if you don't know that there's a big assembly project going on, and historically, sophisticated developers have been able to acquire property without telling people what the ultimate purpose is and thereby overcome the holdout problem. This is how Disney was able to acquire the property for Disneyland, for example. That's a famous example, but there are others. Second, even when there is a genuine holdout problem, there is a question of, well, how should legal rules be structured to try to identify it? And here, I am less confident than Richard may be that sort of we can trust courts to go case by case and say, well, here, after looking at all the evidence, we find that there is a holdout problem and here there is not. I think often courts will not do a very good job of doing those kind of determinations. I think political and other biases will enter into it, and in many cases, it might be better if we had firm, bright-line rules, such as in the U.S., the traditional narrow definition of public use, which was the dominant view in most states in the 19th century, which is that the public use is limited to cases where either it's a government-owned project, like public infrastructure, for example, or it's a privately owned one, but one that has a legal obligation to serve the entire public, such as a public utility. Richard mentioned the mill cases in the 19th century. In many states, courts differentiated between mills that were public utilities that everyone had a legal right to use, and mills that were just ordinary private enterprises, and the second kind of purely private mill was not allowed to use eminent domain. This is an imperfect test from a standpoint of economic efficiency, but it may be the best that real-world courts can do, though I am open to other options, and I'm certainly not saying that every country should adopt this sort of approach in all conceivable circumstances. Finally, on compensation, I think Richard and I agree that where eminent domain is used, there should be compensation, including in many cases above fair market value. I do think, however, it's extremely difficult to figure out what the right compensation should be in many of these cases. Figuring out the extent of your subjective value is actually quite hard. I'm also less confident than Richard that even if you do figure out the compensation correctly, that it will deter all or most abusive takings, because obviously the money that is spent is not that of the government officials who allocated it. It comes from a public fisc, and often there are incentives to misuse it. But overall, I do agree we do need higher compensation, certainly in the U.S., for many kinds of takings, and the same is true in a lot of other countries. So the bottom line, I think Richard and I do agree that this is a big set of problems. There is no one magic bullet that can fully solve the issue, but I think we have made some progress since Kelo. I think there has been some progress in some other countries as well, and my hope is that we can make more of it over time.
One sentence, and then I think we should open it up. In the 19th century, I think probably the majority of states would allow the assembly, even if the mill was not a gristmill open to all but was selected. One of the very clever solutions that was used in one of the cases called Hedvia Moskiag was that the system required that you pay 150% of value in order to condemn land for these particular purposes, and only allow you to condemn bare land, not to condemn homes for that circumstance. And that's designed to basically make you more reluctant to do it when you're claiming a holdout problem, and B, to give you a fixed number so that you don't have to worry about the calculation of subjective value and incidental expenses. This is essentially a disagreement over the last 5 to 10% of the problem, and it's one of degree. On the other problem, I think both of us are pretty much the same, so I guess we should probably open it up, right?
Yes.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound key on your telephone keypad. Looks like we have our first question.
We have a question.
Hello, it's Mary Maxwell here in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Thank you for the talk. I'm sure you're dying to hear a question about private ownership, but this is a little bit about public. And if you can think of a way to comment, please do, but if you, I'll understand if you don't have knowledge of it. Jonathan Sacks was the chief rabbi of Britain for a while, for many years, and he wrote a book called Politics of Hope. And I remember one of the stories he told was about Regent's Park in London, which is always full of happy families on Sunday. And you might say that, I think he also implied that any one of those families, although they don't have a title to the land there, but even title is only conventional, really. I suppose the land belongs to the whole tribe. What if it were taken away? I mean, what if, you know, someone developed on the Regent's Park land next week? It seems that really the individuals who have been enjoying it sort of owned it in a way. I say again, I don't expect you to have a...
This is a very famous question. And it's not just Regent's Park. What happens is there's often a conflict between two types of title. There's somebody who has legal title to the particular property because he got conveyance either from the crown or from a prior owner. And then there are other people who have title which comes from the occupation of the land. And sometimes one person has a customary title and one person has a legal title, and the question of which of these two titles prevails and why. And I think the answer probably goes in two ways. One, if it turns out that the people who are claiming the land believe that their title is dominant, even though it's customary and it's not recorded, giving them a lot of protection against somebody who takes a later deed makes good sense. And this was the huge battle in the British enclosure movements, where the Marxists and the property rights people were on the same side, saying the government couldn't issue paper titles to people to dislodge people who were sitting on the land. But there's also another class of cases in which the title is perfectly clear legally, and then somebody just kind of moves on the land and starts to farm because they haven't been thrown off by anybody else. And I think there the correct body of law is what we call adverse possession. If it turns out that the owner basically throws them off before the statute of limitations runs, he should be able to recover the land. If it turns out that they're on there with the permission of the owner, then there's no statute of limitations problem at all, and he could force them out. It's a very bad mistake to say about to an owner, look, we know you let these people on the land and they're now planting mulberries and you want to build a house. But since they're planting, they basically keep the property and you can't develop. Because at that particular point, then the informal use patterns prior to serious development are going to be stopped by owners who fear the eminent domain problem. So until you know exactly what the state of the play is when the people enter, you can't really give a strong answer to your question. Ilya, do you agree?
Pretty much. I would only note that in many countries in the world, particularly developing nations, there's a serious problem where there's a lot of land which is being used often by poor people, usually public land, but they have no legally recognized property rights, and therefore it's harder for them to develop the land to its full potential, to set up enterprises and the like. Hernando de Soto, the famous Peruvian economist, has written extensively about this in his book, I think it's called The Mystery of Capital, and elsewhere. So I think Richard is absolutely right that if you have a system of private property, we should be careful about it, in effect, giving squatters strong rights that if they start planting something, if they're allowed to do so, they can just take over the land. But in these other systems where you have a lot of officially publicly owned land, but in reality it is being used by private people in productive ways, it would be desirable to have privatization of many of those lands and to recognize the rights of the people who are actually using the land and trying to develop it, and then they could develop it more fully and lift people out of poverty and provide needed economic growth.
You know, one of the things that DeSoto stressed is, of course, which I think is exactly correct, is you cannot have a system of private property unless you have some coherent system of addresses, some coherent system of meets and bounds, and some coherent system of public recordation. And these are functions which have to be done by the state, because if somebody sets up a record office and somebody else sets up a competitive record office, which one do you go to see whether or not the title is valid? And so you have to have the centralized indices, and one of the things that in the Mystery of Capital DeSoto stressed was the point that these things have to be really done well. And I gave these wonderful examples. As you get all these squatters sitting on the land and somebody wants to deliver a bill and they don't know what the addresses are because nobody has any recognized numbers. And so I think the correct answer is you try to get rid of the jumbled titles. The other area where this, of course, becomes extremely important is just things like artwork, where it gets stolen all the time back and forth, and trying to sort out these things could take forever to do. So the instability of possession, which is an old theme by David Hume, turns out to have a lot of real-world applications in dealing with both land and other forms of property.
What I took away from DeSoto was that if your house is built on top of another house, as I guess many of them are, you'd be advised not to go get a title for it.
Well, it depends.
The title can't be sold.
I mean, my favorite place in the world is you go to Israel. And there's some very valuable real estate which has Jewish artifacts on the bottom, Christian artifacts in the middle, and Muslim artifacts on top. You try to figure out what the ownership is, and there's no legal system that will give you a uniform answer to questions of that sort. But trying to avoid ambiguities in ownership is extremely important. But that question is orthogonal to the one that Ilya raised at the beginning in the book, where you're assuming clear private title on behalf of one person and then asking how you can move it into public hands and perhaps after that back into private hands. You're talking about the different problem where you have a taking but you don't know whom you're taking it from because the title is so insecure. I think we should probably take another question if there is one.
Thanks.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Devin Watkins. My question is for just compensation. I know it should be above market value. Should this be a question of fact that's just left to juries to decide what that subjective value is?
Ilya, do you want to take it?
Sure. This is one of the things that makes this area of law very hard, is that there are a wide variety of possible answers to that question, and all of them have problems. So, yes, you could say these things vary from case to case. Let's let juries decide it. But the result of that will be a lot of uncertainty, and also juries may often make mistakes, and also would even experts, if you decide to assign an expert to do this, like a special master or something. You could, on the other hand, adopt a rule saying, okay, you will always get 10% above fair market value, or you'll get 10% for a commercial property but 20% for a residential property or something. That creates certainty, and it does give people some extra compensation, but you will end up with lots of cases where you will either overcompensate or undercompensate. And finally, there are some scholars like Gideon Parkhomovsky who have adopted or proposed fancy schemes under which we can incentivize people to reveal their true valuation. I don't think we have time to go through the details of how these schemes work, but I personally am skeptical that they can, in fact, work in the real world. And precisely because this is such a difficult problem, that's an additional reason that where possible we should try to avoid having to face it by limiting the power to condemn property in the first place. We should reduce the number of instances where we have to deal with this difficult issue. If we do have to deal with this issue, probably on balance I favor, like Richard, some sort of system where there's a set percentage, maybe with variations based on how long you've been in the area or whether it's a residential property or not, maybe some other things. But we have to be realistic and admit that that system, like all the other options, will have some significant flaws. And if you set the compensation too high, that's a real problem. In the extreme, you might even get people lobbying to have their property condemned, which we also don't want.
That last element is not a fictional story. When they started to do some construction for Comiskey Park in Chicago, it was in the 11th District where the then ward leader or the assembly leader was existing, and they set the compensation level so high and they were willing to build you the same home somewhere else, that you had the so-called eager plaintiff problem, people coming there because they could get from the government more than they could ever get in any private affair. Another possibility, which is perfectly consistent with everything that Ilya said, is you just sort of look at the other kinds of expenses that you have and then give some kind of administrative procedure to review them. For example, you have to get an assessment in order to fight the government, or you have to pay moving costs. You could start to build those into the system as well if you don't want to use a subjective value. On balance, I think I probably favor the flat 10 or 15% to cover all of those things, and think it's a will of a wisp to try and pursue individual variations which cost too much to litigate. And I agree with Ilya that the effort to have what we call self-evaluation schemes of one sort or another turns out to be catastrophic. The one that was proposed and still sends thrills through my spine was done sort of 35 years ago by Saul Levmore, and then has been repeated by other people. And what it says is, when you pay your real estate taxes, what you do is you assign a value to the property, and if you assign it low, you don't pay that much in real estate taxes, but anybody in the world could come in and take the property from you at the price that you set for the real estate evaluation. So essentially everybody has to make a valuation of their property for the 1% chance that somebody might want it. And you want to, that's the kind of scheme that Parmashovsky is talking about and so forth. Not only do I think they're unworkable, I think that you would wake up with a political rebellion the likes of which you've never seen in the history of Western civilization if everybody was told that their properties could be taken away from them at any time of the day or night by somebody who thought that the evaluation they put on a tax form was going to determine its market value with respect to condemnation purposes. So I'd rather do nothing than that, but I think 10% is fine. They did try it in England, but they took it away. And the reason they took it away is they said it cost too much money, but that was a good reason to keep it. Because as Ilya said, eminent domain is a last resort, and if a little bit higher on the price means that the government's less willing to use it, then we're all going to be better off in consequence.
Let's go to our next question.
And we got three.
Hi, this is Chris Berger from Lawrence, Kansas. And you're talking about some subjective valuation. I'm interested in what your perspective is on adjoining property owners. So, for example, there are two owners, one of whose property is taken, and upon that property is placed something which is heinous or egregious or just otherwise unattractive. That property owner is compensated in, according to whatever scheme, but then all the neighbors receive no compensation. And how does that fit in?
Well, you know, that was the question that was asked in the recent case by Justice Kennedy. And let me tell you, it's a really nightmarish question. And to see why is drop the question of the property being taken by the government to put on an ugly structure and assume that what your neighbor does is he sells the property in a private transaction to somebody else who puts up the same ugly structure, right? And the question then is, what can you do against the neighbor? And I think the answer is, whether it's a government taker on the one hand or a private taker on the other, what you have to do is to look to the existing set of rules to see whether or not this thing counts as either a violation of a covenant or the imposition of a nuisance. So to give you the two versions of this, what you do is you put up as a stink factory. And at that particular point, the other guy is suffering physical discomfiture. The basic rule is the fact that he acquired the property through eminent domain and was a government agency should not exclude the nuisance from taking place. Unfortunately, under the Federal Claims Act, it's sometimes ambiguous as to whether or not you should recover for nuisances, but the answer should be yes in virtually all those cases. And the second situation is, suppose you have a setback line, which means they can't build within 10 feet of the boundary line, and the government condemns the property and they build right up to the boundary line. The answer is, at that point, they've actually taken your property, i.e. the covenant that's associated with it, and they should have to compensate you for the consequential damages associated with the particular operation. But otherwise, there's always going to be a large class of cases where the guy comes in next door and does something that you don't want to see happen, and you're not going to be able to give any remedy at all. The most famous of these cases was actually way back in the 19th century, where somebody claimed that having a black family move into a white neighborhood was a nuisance, and so therefore could be enjoined. And the judge was Judge Brewer on the Kansas court, who later went to the United States Supreme Court. And he says, you have to show me the nuisance. You just can't say that there's a nuisance because somebody is there. And so what you did is you had a common law rule which handled the other side of your problem. Namely, we don't want neighbors to be able to veto folks whom they don't like by saying, in effect, that they can trump up some kind of a nuisance charge. So it's not just a one-way problem, as you put it. It's a two-way problem. Ilya?
Yeah, I largely agree with what Richard said. I think takings in some ways is orthogonal to this sort of question, in that the question really arises that here is when you look at things that your neighbor is doing on his or her property, which of those activities do you have a legal right to stop and which ones you don't? And I think that is going to be determined in some cases by underlying principles of nuisance law, and in other cases by covenants and other kinds of private arrangements, easements, and so forth. I do think that while there's an endless number of things that our neighbors can do that might annoy us and vice versa, most of the time these situations are best dealt with through some sort of private arrangement. It might be a formal covenant or a private planned community or an easement or the like. In many cases, it's also just social norms. Like, legally speaking, I have the right to make all kinds of annoying noise on my land up to a certain point that my neighbors might not like, but I know that in the long run, it's not in my interest to get my neighbors angry at me, and they similarly don't want to make me angry, so social norms can help in this area as well. Not everything has to be done through the formal institution of the law. And in fact, there's a great book by Robert Ellickson called Order Without Law, How Neighbors Settle Disputes, which is devoted to this very sort of question.
Yeah,
I understand, and I think that's where I settle too, but we're dealing with two different issues, though. One is the right to take, and the other is the compensation for it. So if the court's already determined the right to take for an intended purpose, then kind of presumably then whatever's going on there is not going to violate that. And if we're dealing
it depends on what it does to the neighbor. Because you can have situations where you take land from B and it interferes with a covenant that's created by somebody else.
Right.
It's also, by the way, happens oftentimes when you have one person who owns two plots of land. And what the government does is it takes one. And it says, we'll pay you the fair market value of that plot of land. And that plot of land alone is worth $1,000. But you've got the plot next door, which was worth $1,000. But if you put the two of them together, you could build a bigger house, and it's worth $2,500. And so the question then is whether or not you have to pay for the surplus associated with these two plots of land together. And going back to the old Roman law principles, it turns out that the answer correctly conceived is yes. And the case that they used to give is that you killed one of a pair of slaves who was trapeze artist, and the team was worth more than the two of them separately. And they said that the compensation went not to the loss of the thing, but to the loss of the interest, i.e. the decline in your total value. And that could happen here. The hard case then comes is you own plot A, I own plot B, they take your plot, and the two of us were actually planning to put these plots together to get that extra $500 in value. And the current answer, which is less than purpose, says we can get that $500, but only if there had been a contract of cooperation between us. You're not going to allow people to feign the fact that they've gotten some cooperative venture when they haven't put any signs in order to get the higher compensation. So it turns out this adjunct problem is very tricky. There's a nice opinion in the United States Supreme Court in a case called United States against Miller from 1943, in which Justice Roberts goes through some of these very nice permutations, having a bunch of citations to internal cases, which are actually worth reading.
Looks like we have one more question.
Good. Then we'll finish on time.
Yes. Hi. My name is Laura Peterson. I have a question, please, for Professor Epstein. Professor Epstein, you had alluded to regulatory takings, and in that context, you referred to patent and financial institution questions that were raised. Would you please elaborate on that?
Oh, sure. I mean, look, I've worked on a number of particular areas, but let me sort of mention in the patent question. The case just recently came up in a very interesting Supreme Court case called Mattel against TAM, having to do with the Asian group, the Slants, and the question was whether or not the government could decide to take them from them trademark protection on the grounds that it was invidious. And what Justice Alito did in that particular case was to say, you know what, it may well be that the government has some kind of options to create a patent system or not, but if in fact you've created a patent system, any rights that are created under that system are vested property rights, and the government can't just take them away without some form of compensation. There's been a long argument in this area which saying, well, all these things are really not private property, but they're public grants. And the difference between the two positions is if it's a public grant, we could either revoke it at will no matter what we said or under a very low rational basis test, whereas if we treat it as a private piece of property protected by a recordation system, then you get full compensation. And just think of what would happen if you say that the real value from intellectual property comes from recordation. Well, the real value from land comes from recordation as well. And so therefore you could say, you know, we could wipe out land because the only reason you have value in the land is that we decided to record it. So this is an important issue there. On the other side, when you start to deal with financial institutions, there are a bunch of cases of which the most important are the Fannie and Freddie litigation, where the government essentially had a corporation, and what it said is, we're stripping you of all the dividends and paying them off to the Treasury in a renegotiation of a deal which leaves you unambiguously worse off. And the question is whether or not when you have a share of stock, and the government comes along and says, we're leaving you legal title, but we're taking from you the rights to dividends, the rights to liquidation preferences, and the rights to vote. Is that to be governed under a low Penn Central rule, or is it treated as a per se taking? And the cases thus far, alarmingly bad, have used Penn Central to essentially allow the government to wipe out billions of dollars worth of private money. So this issue is really very alive today in the courts, and Penn Central is used to deal with possessory takings in non-tangible property cases so that the Loretto rule does not cover them. It is a huge issue, not covered in Ilya's book, but it's one that for somebody who works with financial institutions, banks, and so forth, you encounter all the time. Ilya?
Yeah, so obviously Richard has much more expertise in this area than I do. I would merely mention that there is potentially a relevant distinction between property rights which exist as a matter of natural right and those that are purely created by the legislature. It's at least relevant either if you believe in natural rights theory or if you're an originalist, because it looks like in the 18th and 19th century, both courts and legal theorists and others made those distinctions. One area where it comes up, it's discussed actually in my other book, The Grasping Hand, is in debates over the abolition of slavery, in that when slavery was abolished in the District of Columbia and in some states, abolitionists and others argued that slavery could be abolished without compensating the owners because slavery was not a form of property that existed by natural right in the way that property and land does or property and physical objects. It existed only by virtue of positive law, by legislation, and so it could be abolished through legislation as well. And it may be, I say maybe because there is a debate over this question, it may be that at that time it was also thought that intellectual property was also purely created by legislation and not by natural right, though some scholars like my colleague Adam Mossoff have raised questions about that.
It's probably stronger on the other side, I think. But what the interesting thing is, for example, with the trade name, which was at the issue in the Slans case, there were common law trade names, and they were fully protected. But what statutory protection did was to give notice to the rest of the world, so it's make it easier to prove the violation of that what happened in the particular case. So the problem that Ilya raises, and we'll just end on this note, is that is there a different status between the creation of property rights at common law and those created by statute, or do you want a uniform framework to do this? And this gets you into the very difficult problem. So what's so special about the common law when it has rules of occupation and so forth? And we do go back to natural law theories, and what happens is I think you have to give more utilitarian justifications for it. And when you do so, I think basically the property rights proposals for physical and intellectual property, there are differences, but they should never be in the fact that one could be removed by the state at any time and one not. The key difference is for patents and copyrighted, limited terms make perfectly good sense and have always been incorporated, including in the Constitution. But for trademarks and trade names, limited periods of time make no sense at all. Are we over now, Laura?
It looks like we are just about out of time. Would either of you like to make quick closing remarks? Okay.
I'd just like to thank everybody for participating in the call and Richard for his excellent thoughts.
And Ilya for, as always, giving an absolutely sparkling, straightforward initial presentation.
Thank you so much. Just a reminder that Ilya Somon's newest book, Eminent Domain, A Comparative Perspective, is available on Amazon, and you can go to our website to find a link to that. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.